Beloved listeners, across Australia, the age of criminal responsibility is, would you believe, 10 years old. Out of step with much of the rest of the world, most of the countries of Europe, between 12 and 16. And many Australian legal, medical and social work experts want to raise the age to 14. It is sobering to note that of the children incarcerated aged between 10 and 13, 70% are Aboriginal. Next Monday, Australia's Attorneys General will meet and consider raising the age, and to discuss the proposition, three guests. Daniel Daylight is a 33-year-old and for 10 years has been a youth worker in Waterloo and Mount Druitt in Sydney. He's a proud Gamilaroi man and program manager of Creating Futures at Weave Youth and Community Services. Jonathan Hunyor is CEO of the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, and Jonathan's also worked at the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency in Darwin for many years. And Dr. Jacqueline Small is a paediatrician, and Jacqueline is also president-elect of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. She's worked with kids with developmental disabilities for over 20 years. Daniel, Jonathan, Jacqueline, welcome to the Little Wireless Program. And first to you, Daniel. You work with kids who are in and out of prison. How can you describe their experience?
Yeah, thank you for having me. The experience of young people in going in and out of custody is one that is harrowing and one that is extremely traumatic for them. I don't think people understand that when you mention those 10 to 13-year-olds, that they're getting strip searched constantly whenever they leave their units, whenever they go to court. They're limited in their contacts with their family. For Aboriginal people, you know, we're removed away from our culture and our communities, which are such a core being of who we are as people. So just that in and of itself is very traumatic.
Daniel, I wonder if you'd tell us the story of one young bloke you know intimately who had a dad who was stolen, and he was removed from his family to Western Sydney and steals a car to drive to Kempsey.
Yeah, so just, you know, a young fellow who, again, it's that intergenerational trauma of his dad was in the stolen generation. He and his 10 siblings are all removed. And then so his first criminal charge that he gets is stealing a car from Sydney to get home to where he's from, up in on the mid-north coast there of New South Wales, to Kempsey. So it's just that was the start of a long journey in the justice system, but it was a journey that started long before in the care and protection system. And it just kind of highlights the constant failure of some of our systems, that it's the transition of kids in the out-of-home care system into the criminal justice system.
I understand that as a result of 23-hour lockdown, medication and bad food, he put on about 40-odd kilos, but he was able to turn his life around. How?
So he was able to turn his life around. Most of it was driven by himself, like all changes, but it was because the right supports were put around him, culturally safe supports. He worked with Aboriginal support staff upon getting released, and he was able to kind of work his way out of the system, but not through the help of the system. He was a kid who was referred to the Youth Koori Court, which was one of the first, he was one of the first referred to there. And even though he still did a lot of time inside, during that point, it was the first time that he'd seen a bunch of Aboriginal people in the courtroom that were there to support him. And then that was the kind of start of his journey that he's led to be a person that is now, you know, a full-time worker, has kids of his own that he was able to keep, which is unusual for someone who grows up in out-of-home care. So he's just kicking all the goals, but it was because community supports were put in place that were free of the system, that were able to respond to his needs.
I understand, well, clearly you're the first responder when kids get out of jail. And something as simple as a birth certificate can be the difference between surviving in the outside world and going back to jail.
Yeah, so when you get out of custody, especially after a long time, if you don't have a birth certificate immediately when you're released, you can't open a bank account, you can't often get onto Centrelink, you can't do any of the things that you need to survive, which for 18 to 30-year-olds that I work with now, Creating Futures, means that those people oftentimes will go and steal some food, or they'll go and shoplift food and end up straight back in custody for breaching their bail or for a new offence. And it's really just such a basic thing as having a birth certificate. It seems kind of frivolous, but, you know, a birth certificate in New South Wales costs $50 to $60 for you to buy. So when you get out of custody after a few years and you have no money in your bank account, or you don't have a bank account to start with, these are things that some of us may take for granted can really add up and mean that you're not able to get onto Centrelink for at least a month after you get released, which means that you've got someone who's come out of custody, who's already done criminal offences, obviously, to end up in custody, and then they come out and they've got no money and they're on the street. So
I want to go to Jacqueline in a minute, but would you tell me what your Weave Youth and Community Service offers? I understand it's a one-stop shop.
Yep. So what we do there is, so a young person or an adult can come into our office and they can see any one of our caseworkers and get a caseworker who'll do wraparound support. But we also have a counsellor that comes into our office that does drug and alcohol counselling. We have a driving change program, which helps young people to get their licence so that a young person doesn't have to get referred to seven different services to help them out. They can go to one service because, like we mentioned before, these young people are the most traumatised in our community. They're not used to trusting a lot of people. So if we can build that trust with one person that sits inside one office and then are able to wrap that support around them, we've had great success already. Our recidivism rate is 4.11%, which compared to the state average is the state recidivism rate in New South Wales is 56%. So just that alone, that wraparound intensive support that we put in place, it makes a difference. And why governments look for answers, they're not funding us at the moment. Do you know what I mean? So it's one of the things where we're showing you this is what works. Invest in young people, invest in community programs, and they don't offend.
Okay, I want to go to Jacqueline now. And Jacqueline, I'm painfully aware what goes on with an 81-year-old brain, but can you tell us about the 10-year-old brain?
Thanks, Philip. Adolescence is a period of very dramatic change in the brain, second only to the early years of life. And these changes are not so much about a change in the size of the brain, but how the brain is critically wired. So there's a lot of branching that goes on. There's pruning of pathways that aren't used. There's myelination, which is the sheath that is around the nerve cells that enables the brain to perform much more efficiently than what it does when it's younger. There's also differences in the neurotransmitters throughout adolescence, with glutaminergic transmitters predominating for the younger adolescent, and these lead to the impulsive fight and flight type behaviours that are typically seen in adolescents who are more likely to take risks. What we see happening through the latter part of adolescence is the maturing of the prefrontal cortex, and this is kick-started by the surge in sex hormones that occurs in puberty. And the prefrontal cortex is really responsible for the higher executive cognitive functions that we rely on as adults to help us make complex decisions, such as delaying gratification, sustaining or shifting attention, balancing up rewards and long-term goals, the sort of things that are required of us as adults. And in young adolescents between 10 and 14, this part of the brain is just remaining quite immature.
So it's little wonder that these kids are impulsive and take risks. And many of them already face challenges on top of the challenges your average kid would have.
You're absolutely right. And Daniel has highlighted what the research shows us for the vast majority of children who are in detention of this age range. 89% have a neurodevelopmental disability, such as intellectual disability. And the majority
I'm
of those
sorry,
children...
89%?
Yes, that comes from Western Australian data.
Wow.
And the majority of those children, tragically, have not had their disability identified and support provided before they come in contact with the criminal justice system.
They're likely to have a communication disorder, an intellectual disability or learning difficulty, all of which makes them incredibly and increasingly vulnerable.
That's right, and they would have missed out on the support that other children would have received had those conditions been detected earlier. 70% of children are not attending school regularly, missing out on the learning, and up to two-thirds of 10-year-old children, as Daniel has highlighted, have been in contact with the child protection system of one way or another. It's very clear that trauma does affect brain development of the sort that we've been talking about. That sort of trauma does have an effect on brain development, and it increases mental health problems and physical health problems even into adult life.
So you're echoing and emphasising what we've already heard from Daniel, aren't you, that simply being in detention isn't itself traumatic.
That's right. And as Daniel mentioned, the resilience factors have been closely connected to your family, peers and culture and community is lost when you're in detention. And that's been recognised as a vital resilience building and counterbalance to trauma when children experience trauma.
Is there any way of measuring the emotional deprivation that kids suffer if they haven't got love around them?
Well, we can see the behaviours that can result for children when they're not surrounded by the care and nurture that they require through their childhood, and they typically show more problematic behaviours. And we know that's vital for children. And some parents struggle, admittedly. A lot of parents are very stressed and they require the support of their community around them.
This is LNL on Radio National. Download us wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the ABC Listen app. My guests are Dr. Jacqueline Small, Daniel Daylight and Jonathan Hanya. And we're talking about raising the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14. To you now, Jonathan, you saw firsthand when working in the Territory the effect of having kids in the criminal justice system. You say that it simply crushes them.
Yeah. Look, that's one of the things I think is one of the misconceptions in the community is that we imagine the criminal justice system is in some way a useful response for kids who are under 14, and that in some way it may reform them or teach them a lesson or help them to take responsibility. And really, when you're involved in the system, you see that it really does none of that. And it what it does is really crushes kids and teaches them to lose confidence in themselves and lose hope. I mean, there was one case while I was there of a couple of 16-year-old boys who broke out of Don Dale, and they had both a history of contact with the criminal justice system. And while they were out at large, they stole a little white hatchback, a Toyota Yaris, I think it was, and they drove that around. And when the police started to follow them, they drove the car back to Don Dale and drove it at the front of that prison at speed. And to everyone's surprise, bashed through the front of the prison and into the prison yards. And they must have known when they drove their car at the front of the prison that that could have killed them. They couldn't have expected that they'd get in. But it always spoke to me.
And then they did wheelies and donuts.
Until the police apprehended them, which was inevitable. And just that always struck me as such a poignant testament to the failure of the system, that, you know, the system hadn't helped those kids make better choices. The system hadn't helped those kids take responsibility. It had left them feeling so hopeless that they were prepared to risk their life for this sort of gesture of breaking back in.
And Jonathan, before they get into that dreadful place, the name of which will ring in infamy, describe the court processes. They're nervous and anxious with lawyers talking in a way they don't understand. And I guess a better approach is youth conferencing, like in the Koorie Court in Parramatta.
Well, that's right. There are definitely ways that the system, even currently, can be made more meaningful and work better. But ultimately, you know, it's again this misapprehension that somehow the system gets kids to take responsibility. Really, it doesn't. It takes it off them. You know, if you're of any age and you're in the dock in court, your heart's beating. You're not really listening to what's going on. But if you're a 10-year-old, I mean, seriously, you're a 10-year-old. You're not even old enough to be in high school, and you're there in the dock, and the lawyers are talking, and the judge or the magistrate's talking. If we seriously think that that's a meaningful engagement for a kid that they're going to somehow learn from, we're fooling ourselves, and we're really asking the wrong question, because we think the criminal justice system can play some sort of meaningful role in this situation where a kid's life has gone off the rails, and all of the evidence, the medical evidence and all of the criminological evidence shows that it just doesn't. It makes things worse.
Jonathan, for all sorts of obvious reasons, we've been doing a lot of programs recently on police behaviour, both in the US and here. And I'm wondering to what extent police are trained to deal with 10-year-olds. To what extent are the prison officers trained to deal with 10-year-olds?
Yeah, look, I mean, I know that that prison officers and police will get some training in these matters, but the police are there to do a job, but this just isn't a job we should be asking them to do. It's just not, they're not the right tool for this job. When you've got a 10-year-old whose life is going off the rails, why would we think that a good response is to lock them up in a cell, to send someone in who's got a gun? That's just... It really defies logic. And as I say, it defies all of the evidence about what does work.
Well, Jonathan, how would it change if we brought the age of criminal responsibility more in line with the rest of the world?
Well, what it would mean is we'd need to design a system that has a different response. So when a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old, 12-year-old is getting in trouble, we'd need to ask what the problems are and try to solve them. We'd need to have them referred to other services that can be therapeutic and that can actually work with a kid and try to get them to make better decisions, find out what's going on with the community, what else in the community can help. I mean, if we started talking to Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal community organisations, they're ready to do this work. They can do this work. We see in places like Bourke, they are doing this work. It's just a matter of recognising that the people that we need to call in for this problem have a different skill set, a different mindset.
Jacqueline, are you called in to explain the nature of the immature brain by the authorities, or do they just ignore what you know?
I think that is part of what educating about the impact of incarceration is for children, that we need to really recognise that their brain is immature. And I'd have to agree with Jonathan that incarcerating young children less than 14 just doesn't work, and it traumatises them further. And I think we need to much more widely recognise that it is a deeply traumatic experience for children, and what we need to do is find a different paradigm and one that's built on trauma-informed models of care.
Daniel, I'm told the cost of holding a kid in jail is over $1,400 a day, and that some kids rack up over $2 million while in prison. How would you better spend that immense amount of money?
So, as Jonathan pointed out, that there's a really good program called a service up in Bourke called the Maranooka project, which is about justice reinvestment, and that type of thing where we're looking at community-led, place-based solutions is the type of things that work. So Aboriginal community, figuring out what the gaps are in the services and then finding ways to fill that in culturally safe and appropriate ways. That's been a long-running standpoint of the Aboriginal people in this country. I grew up in Redfern Aboriginal Medical Service, and it was always about self-determination and community control. And we've been asking for that since the 60s. And it's the message for us hasn't changed. That still is what works best for our people. But too often that is ignored by the government. And so we're hopeful that if you want to raise the age, it's good to raise the age, but then we also need to invest that money that is saved into our community so our young people never have to spend a day in a cell.
I understand that in Bourke there's been some radical changes to the approach, and a lot of money is being spent on reintegrating kids into the community.
Yeah, so what we're doing in Bourke is about justice reinvestment. It's about trying to take that money from the cells, you know, the $1,400 a day for kids. It's about $400 or $500, I think, for adults per day. That is just so much money when you consider in New South Wales, it's 50% of our kids are Aboriginal in juvenile detention. It's 25% of the adult prison population. So that's a lot of money that's been spent on keeping our people in custody that if it was spent in the communities, we can have things like if you go to Bourke or you go to any country town, it's impossible to have a psychologist there to talk about stuff Jackie's talking about to get you diagnosed. We could pay psychologists to be in these country.
Okay, we're running out of time. And Daniel, I want you to tell us about the Parramatta Youth Koori Court.
Yeah, so the Youth Koori Court we set up a few years ago, and I worked in it to set it up with Magistrate Sue Duncombe, and it's been expanded now to Surry Hills. But it's about getting all the parties into the room. So instead of looking at it from a criminal justice issue, it's about the community and the young person and their family coming together and figuring out what the gaps are and trying to plug those gaps with appropriate services, and not just what the court often does, which is go and see youth justice, go and see community corrections. It's about, well, you might go and see the Aboriginal Medical Service in Mount Druitt or in Redfern. So that's a better place. That's a safer place for you to get your treatment. That will be the plan that you'll follow through the court. And already it's having massive success. And obviously, it's, again, like we talked about with that $1,400 a day, it's saving a lot of money, you know. I know that because I worked in it for so long, I know that we've saved so much money. I spoke about the example before, but since that person's gone through that court, they've never gone through a court again, you know, and I think that's because from talking to the young people, they've never had an environment where they thought that the system was actually trying to help them. And I still don't think that that's the way all the way, but that's what they like about the youth group.
Jacqueline, I'm going to finish with you. We talked about the Attorney's General meeting to cogitate on these matters. Will your Royal Australasian College of Physicians be making a submission?
We have made a submission. We'll be continuing to advocate for this issue, Philip, because it's such a vital one for the health and well-being of these young people. We've talked about their capacity to re-engage with the right sort of supports and development of trusting relationships with their culture and community. But we know without this, there's long-term risks for their mental health and their physical health that we haven't even started to cost in this conversation. So
I thank you all very, very much. It's been riveting and gut-wrenching. And this was LNL on RN. My guests have been Daniel Daylight, Jonathan Hunyor, and Dr. Jacqueline Small.